I'm Steve Potter, and welcome to Cityscape. Later, Erin Williams will talk with Terry Baker Mulligan about her new memoir about growing up in Harlem. And the Big Top returns to Pall Hall. Circus Flora teams up with the St. Louis Symphony for A Child's Christmas in Wales. But first, Anne Williams is a historic interpreter. You may have seen her work at the Old Courthouse or at Kirkwood's July 4th celebration. This month, she performs for the Daniel Boone Home Christmas Candlelight Tour and at the Lemp Mansion. Anne Williams, welcome to Cityscape.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So you're a historic interpreter and are certified with the National Association of Interpreters. So what does that mean, really?
Oh, that means that I took some training and had to pass an examination, write a paper, and do a presentation as well to be certified. And then we have a certain number of hours that we have to do of training to keep our certification.
Mm-hmm. Is it accurate to call you an actor?
That's a good question because I'm not a storyteller. You can tell that when I'm paired up with a storyteller. They're very different. They usually write their own stories or paraphrase stories, and I don't do that.
I'm glad you brought that up because for the last few years, I've emceed the Greater St. Louis Storytelling Festival, and I'm going to do that again next year. I think it's May, if I'm correct. So that was one of my questions. You're not a storyteller?
No, I'm not a storyteller.
How are you different than the storytellers we see at their events?
They seem to be more speaking from what's on their mind and talking as they go, whereas I'm reciting the literature as close as I can, word for word. I think what I do is almost closer to acting than storytelling.
But not exactly?
No, not exactly. I'm not trained as an actress.
I know you've come prepared to give us a couple samples of things that you do, and I know you made a couple selections to sort of contrast Victorian literature with modern contemporary literature.
Yeah.
Would you sort of set that up for us? What do you mean by that? And how are they different?
There's a distinct style from the early 1800s up through about 1850 or 60 that the authors wrote in. Each author had his own style, their language, the words that they used, the phrasing, whereas modern stories are written quite differently, even stories that have a similar theme. When I memorized the Oval Portrait by Edgar Allan Poe, I wanted to contrast it during my October program with a story that was inspired by it, which was The Picture of Dorian Gray. And the style of writing was so different in the modern style. They didn't have the elegance, I'd say, and the phrasing that mm-hmm. they had in the Victorian times.
So is it essential in what you do as an interpreter to quote exactly, recite the exact words, or can you vary at all?
Well, the historic interpretation is separate from what I do with the literature. I just happen to have combined both of them.
Uh-huh.
So as a historic interpreter, I might speak in first person and just present myself as a person that lived in a time period and try to stay within what they would have known and how they would have spoken. Bringing the literature in is just an added-on thing that I've done for special events.
Well, why don't you give us a sample then? I know you want to do part of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens.
Yes. This was written in 1843 by, of course, Charles Dickens. It took him about 6 weeks to write it between October and November. He had gone out to do reporting on the situations that he found in the workhouses and in the prisons and the poorhouses, and he thought that the best way to report on what he found was to write it in the form of a book. So he closed himself off in the house, and he would not receive any visitors during that 6 weeks until he completed it. And when he tried to get someone to publish it all in one piece, they wanted to print it serially, as they did in that time in journals. So he had to publish it himself to have it published as one entire piece, and he paid for that himself. Only 6,000 copies were produced. This is the opening of Stave 2 of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. The bell sounded with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy one. A light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn aside. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand, and Scrooge, starting up in a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor that drew them. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so much like a child as like an old man, viewed through some supernatural medium which made it appear receded from the view and diminished to child's proportion. The hair upon its head was white as if with age, but there was not a wrinkle upon its face, and the tenderest bloom was upon the skin. The arms were long and muscular, the hands the same, as if its hold were of uncommon strength. Its legs and feet were delicately formed, and like its upper members bare. It wore a tunic of the purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of green holly in its hand, and in singular contradiction to this wintry emblem, its dress was trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing was that from the crown of its head sprung a pure, bright jet of light by which all this was made visible, and which was the occasion, no doubt, in duller moments, for the great extinguisher cap it carried beneath its arm. But as Scrooge looked upon it with increasing steadiness, this was not its strangest feature, for as the belt sparkled and glistened, now in one place and now in another, so that what at one moment was light was at another time dark, so the creature fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, and now a head without a body, of which each dissolving part no outline was visible in the dense gloom wherein it disappeared, and by the very wonder of it being itself whole and distinct again. "Are you the spirit whose coming was foretold to me?" "I am." Its voice was soft and gentle, singularly low, as if instead of being close to him it was at a distance. "Who or what are you?" demanded Scrooge. "I am the ghost of Christmas past." "Long past," he asked, observing its diminished stature. "No, your past." Perhaps Scrooge could not have explained it if anybody could have asked, but he had a special desire to see the spirit with its cap on, and begged it to be covered. "What? Would you so soon put out with human hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions have made this cap and forced me to wear it through trains of years low upon my brow?" Scrooge reverently disclaimed any intention to offend, and all knowledge of having bonneted the spirit through any period of its life. He then made bold to inquire as to what brought it there. "Your welfare." Scrooge expressed himself as obliged, but could not help thinking that a good night's rest undisturbed would have proven more conducive to that end. The spirit must have heard his thoughts and added, "Your reclamation, then, take heed." As it said these words, it put out a strong hand and clasped him by the arm. "Rise and walk with me." Its grasp, though as gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. Scrooge rose, but seeing that the spirit made toward the window, he clasped its robe in supplication. "But I am a mortal and liable to fall." "Bear but a touch of my hand here," said the spirit, placing its hand upon his heart, "and you shall be upheld in more things than this." As these words were spoken, they passed through the wall and found themselves on an open country road with fields on either side. The city had vanished completely, and it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground.
That's Ann Williams. I'd call you an actor.
Okay. Okay, we've settled it.
Because I'm watching you and you're making eye contact and I'm seeing what people listening can't see. And, you know, I'm seeing emotion in your face and you're doing some movements. Not only that, you came dressed in character. Describe how you look today.
I'm wearing, the park ranger that made this dress for me, her little girl called it the Fiona dress because I guess it looked like a dress that Shrek's a princess wore. So it's a green moss-colored empire waist dress, which is what they wore between 1790 and 1820. And the cape is a Kinsale cape.
And your hair?
My hair is done in the style that they would have worn through late 1700s into the 1800s with side curls in the front and pulled up in the back.
It takes a little work, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well,
and a lot of hairspray.
That piece you just did, A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens, an example of Victorian literature. Do people, and you do a lot of contemporary stuff, and we're going to have you do something in just a second. Do people react differently to Victorian, the presentation of Victorian literature as compared to contemporary, because it is in such a different style and people did speak in a different way?
I get a wonderful reaction, it seems, no matter what stories I tell. But I'm not exactly going to answer your question. When I do the Victorian literature, or even when I recite the Declaration of Independence, people describe themselves as feeling very moved and oftentimes as being mesmerized or transported. Like if I do the visit from St. Nicholas, they often will tell me they feel transported back to when they were a child. But I think it is the language because it is so beautiful to listen to.
Well, let's try something from modern contemporary literature. You're prepared to do something from How the Grinch Stole Christmas?
Yes, How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Theodore Geisel, or as we know him, Dr. Seuss. Since it's rather long, I'll start in the middle. All the windows were dark, quiet snow filled the air. All the Whos were dreaming sweet dreams without care. When he came to the first little house on the square, "This is stop number one," the Grinchy Claus hissed, and he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist. He slid down the chimney a rather tight pinch, but if Santa can do it, then so can the Grinch. He got stuck only once for a moment or two, then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue, with the little Who stockings all hung in a row. "These stockings," he hissed, "are the first things to go."
Then he slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present. Popguns, bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorn, and plums. He stuffed them in bags, and then the Grinch very nimbly stuffed all the bags, one by one, up the chimney. He slunk to the icebox. He took the hoof feast. He took the hoof pudding. He took the roast beast. He cleaned out the icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took the last can of hoo hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee. And now, grinned the Grinch, I'll stuff up the tree. And the Grinch grabbed the tree, and he started to shove when he heard the small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast, and he saw a small hoo, little Cindy Lou Hoo, who was no more than two. The Grinch had been caught by a tiny hoo daughter who got out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch, and she said, "Why, Santa Claus? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why?" And you know that old Grinch was so sly and so slick, he thought up a lie, and he thought it up quick. "Why, my sweet little tot," the fake Santa Claus lied, "there's a light on the tree that won't light on one side. I'm taking it up to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there, then I'll bring it back here." And his fib fooled the child. He patted her head. He got her a drink, and he sent her to bed. And when little Cindy Lou was in bed with her cup, he crept to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. And the last thing he took was a log for their fire. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb much too small for even a mouse. Then he did the same thing to all the other Who's houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other Who's mouses.
I'm partial to that. I wouldn't be who I am if it wasn't for Dr. Seuss, I don't think. I really enjoyed that. That's historic interpreter Ann Williams. She'll be performing, by the way, tonight and tomorrow night, December 7th and 8th, and next weekend, 14th and 15th, at the Daniel Boone Home, part of their Christmas Candlelight Tour in Defiance. And December 12th and 19th, that'd be next Wednesday and the Wednesday after that, the Lent Mansion. If you'd like more information about these appearances, go to stlpublicradio.org to the Cityscape page. We'll have more information and a link. How did all this begin for you? I know you've been doing the Daniel Boone Home for, what, like 15 years or something like that. How'd you get into this?
The storytelling part?
Uh-huh.
Well, I've been at the Daniel Boone Home as a volunteer historic interpreter on weekends since 1996. And then in 2006, my friend Carolyn out there said, "We're supposed to come up with a new event." And I didn't know that half a dozen places do Halloween storytelling, so we thought we'd do Halloween storytelling. The funny thing was, I didn't know we had decided really to do it until 2007 when I saw it on our list of events, and I wanted to go home for my niece's wedding. Mm-hmm. And our manager at the time took me in the barn and gently convinced me that this would be a more rewarding experience if I did this, so it's her fault.
I do a little acting, and boy, I have trouble with memorization. But, boy, you've got it down, and, you know, you have a pretty big repertoire and something. Does that come easy for you?
No. People ask me if I have a photographic memory. I don't even know what that would be. I have to really work at it. So I'll take a paragraph and read it through twice to get the image or the idea or the thought of it, and then I try reciting the sentences from whatever I can remember from that, and then I'll go back through once or twice and correct them, and then I'll just keep repeating that for a while, then I'll move on to the next paragraph.
Would you do one more piece for us in the spirit of the season? This is a visit from St. Nicholas. Tell me about that.
Washington Irving is the first source of American literature in which we find a mention of St. Nicholas, and this occurred in his History of New York, which was a satirical look at the Dutch who founded New York City. And he mentions St. Nicholas actually placing his finger aside of his nose. And that inspired Clement Clark Moore to write this poem for as a Christmas gift to his three children in 1822. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house. Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. All the stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And I in my kerchief and Papa in his cap had just settled down for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eye should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, from the top of the porch to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves before a hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the rooftop went the reindeer who flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A pile of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry, his droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a round little belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. But a wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work. He filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Ann Williams performs this week and next at the Daniel Boone Home in Defiance, then December 12th and 19th at the Lent Mansion. And with all that, Ann Williams, we wish you a wonderful Christmas and a happy holiday. And thanks so much for sharing what you do with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Cityscape, the story of growing up in Harlem, and later, a child's Christmas in Wales. This is St. Louis Public Radio.